You've landed inside Launch Street, the Business Innovation Podcast, where we interview top innovators out there shaking things up so you can innovate, differentiate, and get further faster. Since you're here, we know you're the type of person that recognizes the importance of unlocking your innovation advantage so you can compete and win. And now, your host, the person that has worked with leading companies like Disney, Procter & Gamble, Arrow Electronics, the U.S. Army Research Labs, and Red Robin on upping their innovation advantage, Tamara Gontor.
Good morning, afternoon, or evening, fellow Launch Streeters. I just have to say, I looked at our podcast stats, and I'm kind of excited to say there are a lot of us in Australia and Germany and Japan, as well as the US and UK. It's so exciting. We are global, people. All right, like all other podcasts, this podcast is full of actionable insights, and it's brought to you by Brility Digital, business growth strategists who examine your company and its challenges in order to utilize the appropriate digital resources and tools to move your company forward. And as you know, I didn't want to just announce a sponsor. I also wanted to tap them for some knowledge bombs. So halfway through our main interview, I take a break and interview Brility president Derek Kuhn on challenges facing business today. It's good. All right, back to the main event. You know, in today's fast-paced world, that the ability to reinvent or change the trajectory of your business to keep up with change is critical. And that's why I wanted to have Skip Pritchard on the show. Skip is an accomplished CEO and growth strategist. He has this just incredible track record of repositioning and growing flailing companies. So important right now, isn't it? We all hit that plateau in business and in life cycles, and many of us are struggling with changing marketplaces where we're being squeezed and pushed. So we talk about how great leaders resist the pull of mediocre and so much more. We dig into his book he wrote called The Book of Mistakes. You're absolutely going to love it. So today's Inside Launch Street guest, Skip Pritchard, is a wild ride. So buckle up. Let's do it. Skip, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
All right. What's the one thing people would be surprised to learn about you?
Oh, I don't know. I think the main thing that people are surprised about is the way I grew up and the fact that my family took in all kinds of people from all over the world.
Oh, wow.
And they had a common theme of having, there was a trouble in their life. So they were addicted to something or abandoned and needed a place to go, that kind of thing. And so growing up in an environment where all these people were showing up was a very interesting way to experience childhood.
So I have to ask, what city were you in and how did all these people even find you?
I grew up in Maryland, and how they found me, our family, I'm not quite sure. There was a sexual abuse clinic that would send people who were abused and needed a place to stay and knew that they could come there. Other people, it was word of mouth.
Wow. And,
but it was the whole gamut. I mean, we had all sorts of people, all ages, and some would stay a night, but many people stayed months, and we had few people stay for years.
God, you must have met the most interesting people.
I really did. And you learn a lot watching people. I would watch people leave, and some would get hooked back onto drugs or whatever their issue was and cycle back, and others would go off to, say, community college, get some skills, go get a great job, and turn their life around. Just the full range of human experience.
I wonder if that really formed kind of your expertise and what you focus on today when you look back at those experiences, not consciously, but just having that experience in itself as a child. It's so fascinating.
You know, I think it formed me in two ways. The first is the study of people and what makes them tick and how and why they operate. And the second way it impacted me is I never, ever answer the door if the doorbell's ringing, no matter what, because I grew up where the person might come in and stay for years. So I'm very hesitant to, unless I know you're coming, I just ignore the door completely.
That's so funny. I actually do the same thing. And I have a home office too. So like I really, in the middle of the day, unless you are intentionally coming over to have a conversation with me and I know you, I don't answer the door. My neighbors have learned that. They have to text me. I'm coming over. I need milk or whatever. That's but right. they have otherwise, to tell me, otherwise I won't answer the door. I don't even look. I don't want to see the people.
I get it.
So let's talk about the Book of Mistakes, which I love the title. I love the cover. Well, I really love the book. But let's back up for a second for listeners. Talk to us a little bit about what it's about and why you wrote it. And then I want to dig into it.
Sure. Well, the book is a story about a young man named David who is very stressed, very disheartened, has a job, but he's just like, my life is not what I really wanted it to be. I'm not achieving. I'm not doing everything that I wanted. And then he runs into a young woman and everything starts to change. He goes on this mysterious journey where he's learning from 9 teachers. The 9 mistakes that people make that limit their future. And we often learn these mistakes later in life, but if you would learn them early, he learns that it would change your life so much for the better.
So this book is those mistakes.
This book is those mistakes. And really, these mistakes were taken from the fact that, kind of the way I grew up, I watched these mistakes in action. And B, I've interviewed over 1,000 very successful people. Been a CEO of several global organizations, and I've kind of seen these themes keep coming back. And each one of them is supported by research. And so I put it in the form of a story because I wanted people to be entertained and kind of take it in a different way rather than in a traditional nonfiction way.
So I know we can't go into all of them because of time, and I want people to buy the book. But talk to me a little bit. What's one that's in there that maybe – I don't know if you found it surprising or just profound when you kind of realized, hey, this is one of the big mistakes. And if you could share a story here around that too, that would be great.
You know, mistake number 2 is a big one. And it's one that we find is formative for us often in our younger years. And the mistake is allowing someone else to define your value. It's such a key mistake. You know, we let somebody label us. We let somebody say something to us as a label and it sticks. You know, you're not good at speaking, or, you know, you're not an artist, or you're not good at sports or whatever. And we let these things stick on us much longer and much more often the negative than the positive. And it just bothers us. It's something that's there. Somebody told an artist recently, well, you're more a craftsman than an artist, in a very derogatory way. And it's a very, very dangerous thing to do. You know, in the book, I talk about this. It in the U.S., to make a nickel, it costs almost 10 cents or 10 to 12 cents.
It's ridiculous.
But it's worth 5 cents, right?
Right,
why?
Yeah.
Well, because we labeled it a nickel.
We decided it was a nickel, yeah.
We decided it's a nickel. And this is what we do. We allow other people to label us, and then we reduce our value, and we reduce our future because we've allowed these negative labels to stick on us.
So let me ask you a question around that, because I mean, I think me and those of us listening can really relate to that, right? Like, I never forget in junior high being told I was bad at math, and I just carried that for a very, very long time, that clearly math was not my thing. And but how do you know if it's something that someone else is putting on you versus your own insecurity? Or like, I'm trying to figure out how you identify those things so that you can shed them.
Well, I think first of all is accepting them, and does it limit your potential for what you want to do? I mean, I think that's the key, right? If somebody tells me, Skip, you're not really good at calculus, it really doesn't matter to
like
me
that's
at all.
Nice.
I'm not using calculus in my day-to-day life.
Right.
But if it's something that's core to what I want to do and it's limiting my future, it's limiting my purpose, then it really does matter. And it matters not just personally, but it matters in business, because our businesses can be labeled too. In fact, if you look at some of the most famous advertisements that are successful, it's when they limit. You know, I love that the old Mac versus IBM, think different, think, et cetera. They're playing back and forth. They're kind of labeling, we're the innovation team, we're not. It's all around these labels we accept. So it depends whether it's limiting your lane or not. If it's outside your lane and it really doesn't matter to you, who cares about that label? But if it's something that's going to stop your goals or slow you down to where you need to be, then you need to dig in a little bit deeper and determine, okay, why is this sticking? What is it? Is it my lack of self-confidence? Some people then use that as a fuel. Oh, you think I'm not a speaker? And then they start taking all these classes. They become a master public speaker because of it. So sometimes it can be used as a fuel for you to innovate, change, drive for success in a different way.
So, you know, what's interesting about, for me, about what you're saying, and I'd love to get your perspective on it is, you know, in our world of innovation, which is kind of, you know, the perspective that we come from on this, on Launch Street and our listeners, is that is a label that really hinders or helps people get ahead in their work, in life, really. So oftentimes, you know, what I see with companies is they label a certain set of seven people innovators or innovative, and then the rest of us are not, and we're told we're not, and then so we believe we're not, and then we keep our head down, and then suddenly we're told we're supposed to be, and we can't because, you know, we've been squelching that side of us for so long. I mean, it feels like it has such a big impact, things like that label, on the work that we do.
It absolutely does. You know, first of all, I've led companies where I was told when I started in the company, well, here's our innovation team.
Right. And so the five cool people.
That's right. I quickly disbanded the innovation team because we're all innovation.
Right.
Team.
Yeah.
And
I love that.
Innovation. How do you define innovation? Somebody might be innovative creating a new idea. Somebody may be innovative on a process. Somebody may be innovative in running a meeting that makes it take half as long and twice as effective. Everybody has some skill in creativity and innovation. It's just finding your natural skill set that you can kind of use to drive that. So I think it's very dangerous to allow just a few people to have that halo and everybody else is kind of beneath them. I don't think that is the way our brains are designed.
I love that you said about the halo. That's so true, right? We wait for them to, you know, ordain us with their brilliance while we sit back and wait. It's such an interesting dynamic. And for launch readers out there listening, really pay attention to what Skip's saying here about dismantling the innovation team and recognizing that innovation happens in a lot of different ways. And this actually kind of segues great into the next question I wanted to ask you. It's one of the quotes that I loved from your book, and it was that great leaders resist the pull of normal. I wanted to understand from you, what is that pull of normal and why is it so strong?
You know, the pull of normal is to take everybody to mediocrity.
Yeah.
And anybody that stands out, you kind of see as, well, you know, get back in line. We want you to be back in this box. That makes me comfortable. It's in my comfort zone. Great leaders are the ones that are pushing people outside of that comfort zone, that are pushing past normal, that are pushing to the extraordinary. I mean, the reason it's extraordinary, it's extraordinary.
Yeah.
Ordinary is where we pull people to. And so how do you encourage that, resist the pull of the normal, and encourage that extra piece, that extra something? And you have to have a whole culture around that. You want to let people be great and not pull them back to this mediocrity, which, of course, is comfortable. You know, pull to the normal, sit down on the couch, watch TV all day. That's normal. Well, that's not going to get you anywhere.
So if as an individual, because I'm sure you faced this before, what do you do? How do you pull yourself out when you realize that people are tugging you? Because oftentimes it's like, I can't remember I'm horrible with analogies or metaphors, but you know, it's like they have a little piece of your little toe and they're just like gently pulling you down and you're like, wait, so what do you do to release from that?
Well, it depends on the circumstances, but I often find that one of the big things that you need to do is look at mistake four, which is surrounding yourself with the wrong people, because the wrong people will pull you down. The wrong people will kind of be nipping at you. And the key is limit your time with them. And you can't eliminate them completely from your life, but limit your time with them. Surround yourself with people who are going to make you the best version of yourself, make your company the best version of itself, and don't drag yourself down into their level that they're pulling into. But that's what they're trying to do.
Yeah. Do you think part of that in that mistake is also recognizing that you're just going to piss some people off and you just kind of have to deal?
I think it's true. You can't make everyone happy. And but it's so subtle. I mean, there's even research that says if you have a 5-minute episode of anger that somebody kind of blasts at you, your immune system is affected for 6 hours.
Oh.
And this type of research, and there's lots of studies. I mean, there's hundreds of studies of the social relationships and the impact it has on your success, or you know, whether it's your earnings or especially your happiness. You are going to tick some people off, sure, if you eliminate them, but it's so very, very important. I mean, you have to look at this and guard the people that are around you as importantly as you would guard anything else in your life. And negative people can just pull you down the wrong path.
You know, a friend of mine gave me a visual that really helped me, that just, it reminded me with what you're saying. It's the rings of Saturn. And there are people who are on the inside rings, and they're the ones that you really open up to and that are part of your core team. They're the ones that kind of, to that mistake that you're just talking about, really are in your group. And then there are people who, kind of to your point, you can't get out of your life. So, but they're on the outer rings. And on the outer rings, you don't get as much information. I don't take what you say as personally or seriously. Like, I know how to manage you on an outer ring versus an inner ring.
That's great. I love that. That's a really good analogy. And just learning also how to accept the information that's coming at you and put that in perspective, I think, is really important.
Yeah. And hard to do, though, isn't it? Like, I think that takes experience, or really doing it over and over again.
It does. And it takes a lot of practice in mastering a pause, mastering a breath, and looking at something from a different way. And, you know, when we, you know, I've listened to so many of your podcasts, when we think about innovation, even innovating the way we think, when we're taking that information in and somebody's doing that, we can kind of turn it. And instead of thinking about the blast that's coming at us, we can become fascinated by it. And let's say, you know, I'm going to study the why you're reacting that way. I become fascinated with your emotional reaction or the way you were operating so negatively. And it puts me out of this receiving this into more of a student. And I'm fascinated by your reaction. Sometimes I'll stop and say, oh, your reaction, that was fascinating to me. Seems to be hitting a chord, and we'll switch to a completely different subject because of it.
For launch readers out there listening, I would, funny, take a pause. I didn't mean to put that pun in there, but, and really listen to what Skip is saying here, because I think that understanding the why and the layers behind what people say is more valuable, actually, most of the time, than what they originally say. And it does give you that moment to get curious versus getting defensive. And one of my favorite things to do to people is when they ask me a question is, before I answer it, I always like to say back, well, interesting question. What makes you ask that? Or, oh, interesting comment. Tell me more about what makes you say that. Because that's where the gold is, I think, before, regardless of what they say.
Absolutely agree.
Yeah, I love your pause thing. That is so important. Before I go on to my next question, I just kind of, something popped in my head. I'm just curious, when you think about the 9 mistakes, were there any that surprised you? Like, huh, I wouldn't have thought of that as a mistake. And here we are all doing it.
I don't know if they surprise me as much as the fact that they interrelate. Which surprises me, that some relates so well to another one, and because of that, they build on each other. That they're not separate; they're kind of all in this unit.
Do you think then, if we're doing one of them, we're doing most likely doing all of them?
Yeah, I think all of us make all of them at different times, and you'll find yourself caught saying, "Okay, I'm doing this." Too often. It's particularly interesting to me when you see somebody master one and do it in a real public way. You know, one of the mistakes is, mistake 3 is accepting excuses, because we all do it.
Yes, of course.
And I'll never forget this one time. It was a Monday morning meeting, and we all knew it was going to be tense. We had lost a major customer. And the customer had said, we lost it. And they said, it's because of this single person, and had a litany of, you know, problems and reasons why this person was like the horrible, horrible, most worst person in the world.
And that was someone on your team.
and that person happened to be presenting that day.
Oh, geez.
And I will never forget what happened. And this is why these things stand out, because – He walks into the room, sits down, didn't even wait for a question, and he immediately launched into this talk that he, I guess, had prepared, because he said, "I'm sorry. I take responsibility for this. It was my fault. I could argue with this letter, but it's true. And I'm going to tell you, this is what I'm going to do. I'm flying out there to apologize in person on my dime. I'm going to win that customer back and start that today. I'm going to win enough new business to make up for the revenue loss. And I'm even hiring a coach to help me not make this mistake again."
And wow,
we were all like blown away. I mean, right. The normal answer is defense, DEFCON 3. Here's all the reasons why this person's wrong. It's amazing. Wow. Right. Just to have that total different reaction and say, I'm not going to accept excuses. I'm going to accept responsibility. And I really learned from that, because the power in that was full accountability and responsibility. And the opposite is what we think. We think, oh, we're going to have to run from it. We're going to have to defend it. We're going to have to blame somebody else. We're going to say the person's wrong. Complete opposite response. It's my fault. I did this. I'm not going to argue with it. I'm going to fix this, and here's how. And immediate action. And I'm flying out to go apologize in person. And that's it. Not going to try to argue. Just I'm going to apologize. What do you do with that? I mean,
applaud. I don't know.
Applaud. We did. That's what happened. And this is somebody who this could have been a major career limitation. And instead, this person ends up getting promoted.
Wow. And did he win the customer back?
Won the customer back. Now, it took a year.
Of course.
Took a year. But that's okay. A little over a year. That's okay. And yet the lesson that he learned was one thing, but the better lesson was for all of us. Like, wow, it was quite a powerful lesson.
Hello, Launch Street. I am here once again with Derek, who is the president of Brility, and he's going to throw some wisdom bombs on us. So, Derek, here's my question. As the president of Brility, you interact with clients across a whole range of industries. What have you seen across the industries are the biggest challenges facing business growth today?
Hi, Tamara. That's a great question. The biggest challenge, without a doubt, is a concept we refer to as liquid turf. The dynamic environment of business right now moves at an exceptional pace. We have technology that's changing. We have business forces that are changing. We have regulation, international competition. The rate and pace of change is dizzying. And then add to that a lack of time and money and resources. It's quite challenging right now.
So here's my question about that, though. I mean, wouldn't a smart strategy help you manage change?
That's exactly correct. What we find, however, is people don't really understand strategy. They have goals and aspirations, and they have a detailed to-do list and a plan. A strategy is something really between those two. I mean, it's interlocking concepts that have compounding effects that are based on research. And most importantly, Tamara, the strategy is a living, breathing thing. It needs to be dynamic and adaptive to the future. And that's where we come in with our digital approach. We build systems that adapt the strategy as the market changes, as we learn more, as your business objectives may expand or contract. That's really is the key.
So how does Brility, how does your company help solve those challenges for your clients?
That's another great question. We will sit down. We go over the objectives of the client as well as their current thinking and momentum. And then we do what's called a digital presence assessment, where we map out all of the different technologies and market forces that could inform our strategy on how to achieve those objectives. And we present the client with the options. And from there, we can collaborate and make informed plans and decisions, as well as a coherent action plan.
So, Derek, this might be a naive question, but why is a digital platform so important to strategy and growth today?
Well, that's a great question. It is the immediacy and the granularity of the feedback. We are able to learn so rapidly and adapt so rapidly if everything is set up correctly, that the best way to keep up with the pace of the marketplace is both to grab opportunities as well as to handle challenges is through the digital platforms.
All right, Launch Street, I'm going to go, first of all, make sure that I have a dynamic strategy and not a set in stone goal. And I would hope that you would all do the same now that Derek has helped me understand the difference. Derek, thank you so much for coming by today.
Thank you.
You know, what I love about your story is, and this person, is that it really, that's a great example of true full accountability versus, look, I'll take responsibility for this, but blah, 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 which you, I think you hear people do all the time, this kind of half-assed accountability,
right.
for lack
right.
of a better way to say it. But, and this is a very obvious question, but I want to dig into it a little bit. What is the benefit of taking real accountability and working away all those excuses and like real accountability like that guy, even when it's really hard?
Well, I think the benefit is you're showing up authentically. You're showing up in a much more comfortable way. And when you're authentic and you're true to yourself and your company is true to itself, there's enormous power in that.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. It's a little bit of a sequitur, but I think it relates to this. One of the things I got clear on recently is when I talk to people, clients, potential clients, that I really wanted to make sure to add value to them in the calls, right? Not just try to sell them, but really add value. And sometimes that meant disagreeing or giving them a different perspective on what they were saying. And when I first started doing, I was very concerned that we would lose business. I was sweating a little bit, in all honesty, like, oh my God, I'm about to tell this person that I think having an innovation team is actually a bad idea, and here's why. And it's grown our business tenfold easily because I think people really recognize when you're coming across truly trying to add value and being authentic. I'm not trying to be contrarian. I just want to give them what I think is what's best for them to know.
There's far more power. That's right.
Yeah.
It's far more power in that.
It's really interesting. And it's I think just for launch readers out there listening, just know that it's hard. But once you feel better about it, I sleep better at night too, knowing that I said what needed to be said, or at least what I thought needed to be said. You know, part of the other thing that you wrote about is, and I think this goes into accepting kind of stigmas about you were talking earlier, is you talk about not accepting the limitations others put on you. And maybe we covered this a little bit earlier, but to me, limitations can be a lot of things. Like they can say, you know, okay, well, you're not creative or you're not innovative. Or it can be things like you'll never get that passed. That'll never happen. They'll never go for it. And those are other types of limitations. What do you do there?
Yeah, people will always come up with their limitations. And this is why they kind of do all relate, because it can be
right.
an excuse.
That's like a push
it can be
to
the
normal
wrong people.
Yeah.
Right. It can be all these things. And yet it's these very limitations. First of all, you just have to recognize what they did. I find, just like you just said, that speaking the truth to your client, recognition is most of the problem. And I step back and I go, wait a minute. I recognize what you just did. You just gave me a limitation. And I need to recognize that for what it is. And sometimes it may be, quote, a real limitation. Most of the time, it's a inquiry for how are we going to innovate around this, right? It's saying,
well,
hey, here's
a
limitation.
That.
Well, it may be, we have a limitation. The market won't bear that. The price is too high. And Starbucks took the price of coffee, right?
It
was going down
$1.50,
25
yeah.
nickel. And all of a sudden it's $5, right?
Yeah.
And you would have said at the time, well, we can't do that. That's right. a limitation. Really, that was an invitation for innovation. And so often we need to reframe that limitation and start asking some good questions around that very limitation to figure out another way around it. I look at them as invitations for innovation.
Love that limitations are just a invitation to innovate. That's fantastic. For launch readers out there, like, what a great way to think about when people say it can't be done. It's not the way it works. And what I also love about it, and it kind of loops back to your accountability, is it kind of puts the onus on me to go, but how can I figure that out?
Exactly. That's exactly right. And it becomes a challenge. And it may not be your own challenge. Get a team together and say, let's figure this out. Let's figure out how are we going to get around this. And you'll see some of the best innovations, right? Because creativity needs these limitations and constraints. That's what it's all about.
Yeah, I think that's really true. And I think we make the mistake of thinking that you need no boundaries, blue skies to innovate. And the structure and the limitations actually force you to be more resourceful and scrappier. So I think they're actually really helpful.
Most of the biggest innovations happen early stage in garages for a reason.
Yeah, yeah, that's right, right. So I feel like that was the money shot that limitation is the invitation to innovate. So I think we're done. I'm just kidding. I feel like a couple more questions. But that really, like, that is just such a profound and I think freeing way to think about it. So if you're in an organization and you're constantly getting hit by limitations, which you are oftentimes, especially if you're kind of trying to pull out of the normal, what a great mindset shift in how to think about all those limitations you get bombarded with. That's fantastic. Okay.
Excellent.
Here's the question I wanted to ask you. I've been waiting for, because it was one of my favorite lines, and it's the loudest microphone is the one in your head. And I think this is especially true when it comes to being uncomfortable, taking risks, being innovative. Talk to me about that voice and how we overcome it, because it's like these little gremlins in our heads, right?
It's so true that we allow so many people to just come up to our microphone and blast us.
Yeah.
Why?
I don't know.
Why do we do that? And we need to stop and say, wait a minute, I'm not allowing you to just own that microphone in my head. And there are various techniques that I've learned over the years to change that. I mean, sometimes if something's repeating in my head and I have the person just constantly grabbing that microphone, I literally visualize that person shrinking down. I change the pitch of their voice. I make them talking really high pitch, and then I let them fade away, and then I blow that person into the dust. I mean, you just can't let that take over. And the same is true with filling that microphone with the things that will take you to where your goal is. So this podcast is one. What are you reading? You can deliberately choose things that you're putting into that microphone that will counterbalance any negative things and that will educate you, entertain you, inform you for the positive. But if you're just filling yourself up, I mean, if you just read complaint after, if you just sit there and say, well, my job is to handle complaints and that's all you do, you're going to end up with a very warped view of things. And that voice in our head is something we need to guard. And you can literally change that voice by changing what's going into your mind.
So I have a hard copy of your book. Do you have an audio as well?
I do. I read it in New York and that was a fun experience.
That's awesome. I'm asking because, you know, I think for me, one of the things that really helps me just for Launch Streeters, for all of us, I really love having books like yours, The Book of Mistakes, and actually having it so that when that voice starts to get really bad in my head, that I actually turn to my Audible and I put on my book, whatever it is. Right now, I happen to be listening to one by Noah St. John, but because I have your hard copy, I need to get the Audible now. But
it takes you away. It's so true.
Yeah.
It takes you away. It literally puts that microphone in a different place,
yeah.
And it's going to give you something that builds you up instead of, I mean, we're drowned with negativity all the time. And what do we do? I mean, what do we do? We have thousands of positive things that happen, but the one thing that happened, right? That's the one we have on replay.
Right. That's exactly right. And I'm sure you do a lot of speaking too. It's that, you know, I'll have 100 amazing, could not have been a better keynoter. I my life has changed reviews. And then I have one person who goes, meh, didn't really speak to me. And I'm like, oh my God, I got to focus on that one person.
That's
and it's
right.
just rolls around in my head on the entire plane ride home. And I'm like, what am I doing?
That's right. And what you realize is sometimes because of the microphone that person had going on in their own head, they
right.
didn't actually even hear your keynote.
Right. Had nothing to do with me, it turns
had
out.
Had nothing to do with you.
Yeah. I really like the way you say it about the loudest microphone is in your head because that makes me feel like I can control it versus it just being my inner monologue, which is hard to shut down.
It's very true. And we do have to learn to direct it. In fact, I think learning to direct your inner monologue is one of the most important keys to your future success.
So you had mentioned you had a couple tactics, one being then listening to something on the flip side, positive, affirming, that helps get you out of it. Do you have other things that you find really work to get rid of it? Not get rid of that microphone, but fill it with the right stuff and then kind of stop the negative?
Yeah, I do just what you do. We get in that feedback. You give a keynote. You have all these wonderful positive comments. I have wonderful things that come in that employees will write to me. I keep all that stuff in a folder. I print it out and I keep it on a digital format. And I, when I'm feeling down or whatever, I go back if I'm hearing that negative voice and I start reading positive, 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 positive. Wait a minute. This changed my life. This gave me a new thought. I didn't realize this. You sparked this in me. I appreciate this. And all of a sudden it just re-anchors you back to what matters. And you just keep doing it. Just keep reading it. Just keep reading it. So I find that to be very helpful. Also, the key thing is for me, I'm an action-oriented person, and part of it's the way your brain and everything is designed. But taking action really matters to me. So the more you start helping somebody else, and it may be something like volunteering, it may be going to a nursing home, going visit a hospital and somebody that's sick. I have a lot of people in a nursing home that swear that I'm their son.
That's very sweet.
And I just go with it. Just go with it. But the thing is, you can get a hug from someone, and you can volunteer. You can do something. You can just give to others. It just gets you out of that, because sometimes introspection and internal micro just start get just act. Go, move, do something. And it really moves your environment and the way you're thinking in a very powerful way. Orients you to others and externally instead of kind of inwardly.
Yeah, I'm very action oriented too. So for me, it's I have to put myself in motion. But I do think in general that works versus just sitting and stewing in it, because that's what we end up doing otherwise, which is not healthy at all. You know, you had mentioned kind of how your brain works. I want to bring it back to you for a minute. How do you innovate when you think about it? Are you, you know, you'd said being an action, but are you an inquisitive type person? Is it because you're willing to take risks? Kind of when you think about the innovation you bring to the world in all the different ways, how do you do it?
Well, for me, it's a combination. Sometimes I go off and do it alone. I wrote most of this book on a flight. I give full credit to Qantas Airlines
because
they didn't have good movies on my flight to Australia.
Ah, see, it's a limitation that turned to an invitation to innovate.
But most often I innovate in teams, and we build off each other. You know, somebody will have an idea, somebody else will add to it. I find it extraordinarily motivating to work with really very talented people who are all skilled and add a new thing. You know, it is like making soup, right? Somebody else throws something in and all of a sudden you end up with this incredible creation that, you know, you could have thought about all night long and never would have dreamed up something as innovative as you ended up with. And so for me, small teams are good. And to have a small team like that, you have to know each other. You have to understand each other. You have to spend time with each other personally and professionally. You have to know each other's strengths and weaknesses. And you have to feel safe, right? Because some people will just hold back and you have to elicit their kind of thinking, deep thinkers, and you want to let them process a little bit longer. But getting all that out, you just end up with this rich thing. That's why the more diverse your team, the better your innovation and result, because everybody's thinking. And this is what I learned growing up, because we were all arguing about the same thing, but we came from these completely different worlds. And somebody would say, "You don't know what this experience is like for me," and would talk about their experience growing up with this or that happening to them. And you're like, "Wow, I really didn't." But you can live through them and see things through a different prism and end up with a really much better answer.
Yeah, I think, you know, ideas that come from birds of a feather tend to die.
That's true.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah, and if you got a diverse team, those ideas tend to really thrive to exactly what you're saying. I mean, I almost think of it as storming the castle. So if we don't do it from all angles, it's going to work. And the same thing is true for ideas, right? We need it, an innovation of any kind. It really needs to be thought through from all angles. And the reality is, I was just telling someone this the other day, it's really egocentric of us to think that we have all the answers. So there are holes in my thinking. I know that. And I need to talk to you, Skip, to figure out the holes, because you're coming at it from a different perspective. So I need that to have better ideas.
It really does refine your ideas and makes them so much better. And you're right. I think about, you know, birds of a feather, because if you think the same way, you think, oh, this idea will land this way.
Yeah.
And then you have somebody say, well, this is how we would experience the very same words. We use these words and you go, oh, no, in my community, these words mean this. And you're like, wow, I had no idea that's what that meant.
You know, I just had a colleague put up a meme that said, just say no to something, something. And she's Canadian. And I emailed her and I was like, I just want you to know that anybody over 40 relates just say no to Nancy Reagan.
Nancy Reagan.
Yeah, right? So, you know. So I was like, I love what you're saying. I just want you to know from a diverse perspective, this is how it's taken in, if you're marketing over here in the U.S. Just letting you know that that's coming across a little bit different than you mean it to. And she's like, oh my God, I would have never known. I'm like, of course you wouldn't because you didn't grow up here in the 80s.
Exactly. I mean, all those words have connotations today, right? I mean, you can't talk about a wall without meaning something.
Right.
You can't. It everything just depending on that context really does mean something completely different. And they don't know, right? How would you know if you didn't have that experience?
Yeah, and I think that about great innovation too. Even if I come to the table with something brilliant, there are things that I don't know or haven't thought of that will make it much stronger. That I need your perspective on. And, you know, I'm curious, and maybe it kind of relates back to one or two of the mistakes too, but in your work, what do you think stops individuals from innovating?
I think fear can stop innovation because it's a risk. I think that being in your comfort zone can stop innovation very, very easily. I mean, this incredible company, typewriter company, Smith Corona, had invented all kinds of new technologies, grammar checkers, personal digital assistants, all these things. But they went out of business because their mission statement and their comfort zone was typewriters.
Right.
So, you know, you can play it safe and end up limiting your future. But it really depends on the company or the individual, what's limiting. But fear is a big thing. And just letting yourself be limited by lanes, by labels, by setbacks, by thinking that, you know, a lot of people think that there's just this fixed amount of success and you can't go after the whole world. And all of these things, just you're just putting up your own individual walls that are pulling you back instead of driving forward.
So this might be a personal question, but you've mentioned lanes a few times and how you get kind of trapped in a lane. What do you do, or what's your advice for people to do when they realize I'm trapped in a lane and this isn't even the lane I want or what it should be?
Yeah, I think it requires you to pause and reflect and look at what's giving you energy. It is determining, the very first mistake is working on someone else's dream.
Right.
If I'm working on someone else's dream, I'm in the wrong lane. In that analogy, and pause and say, well, what gives me energy? Where do I want to be? Am I in the place where it's taking me and my business and my team where I want to go? Or am I just kind of in this place because I found myself there? I mean, the last thing you want to do, but so many people do, is find themselves drifting. And then they're right over Niagara Falls, ready to go over, going, wait, how did I get here?
Right. Because it's one step at a time.
It just happens. And, you know, this happened and that happened and life happens. That's, again, the pull of the normal. And the extraordinary people recognize it, pause, stop, look, assess, say, wait a minute, where do I want to be? And now how do I deliberately take action to do different? I might deliberately take a class. And today it's so easy, right? You can go online. You can watch things. You can just alter your education and change where you want to go. And don't allow yourself to drift. But oftentimes we're squeezed into these lanes by traffic, by the people around us, by the circumstances that are pushing us, by the competitive nature. And we feel like we're in Los Angeles traffic. We're just squeezed. Oh, I have no choice. I can't move. All the time realizing that we could just
get off the highway.
Yeah. Get off the highway.
Just do something. That is really well said. That part in particular about you're squeezed. Like all the traffic, all the people around you squeeze you in, and you didn't mean for it to happen, but it did. You did. You let it happen without even knowing it. And I just kind of was, as you were talking, was reflecting back. I'd climbed the corporate ladder to very high and realized that, you know, I'd gone up one rung at a time and realized that my ladder was on the wrong wall, but it took me until I got to the top to realize it. I was like, oh, yes. No, this right. is a problem. Nah. I think drift happens so accidentally and so naturally, and you really have to be mindful every day of drift. Someone said to me once, you can't get clean on yesterday's shower. And I think that relates to drift too. Like, I think it's not, I don't know. Tell me what you think. For me, it hasn't been something I could decide once and then be good. I've had to really be mindful of it every day.
I think that's powerful if you are mindful about it every day. And I think that's the kind of waking up and consciousness you need to have about yourself and your career and your life, because most people will drift until they're in a crisis, right? Then they have a mental breakdown. They have a midlife crisis. They are fired from their job. Like, something is, you're headed to a crisis instead of taking charge. And so often we take charge of our day at work and we don't take charge of our life. And what a tragedy that is to not reverse it. Jim Rohn gave me the best advice I ever heard when he said, work harder on yourself than you do on your job.
Oh, great advice.
And I think that to me is so important if you want to change where you're going. And it's so easy to work hard on your job and get, you know, okay, I'm doing this. And wait a minute, that's drift.
Right.
Work hard on yourself. That makes all the difference in the world.
You know, it's so interesting. I find that the people, successful business people that I really admire and the most innovative ones, and that success can be defined in a lot of ways, but when I look at those people, they spend a surprising amount of, not surprising actually given what you're saying, but they spend a lot of time working on themselves, being a better person, self-improvement, learning new things. And I remember in my kind of younger days really thinking, oh my God, they're just saying that because they're rich and they have time. You know what I mean? Like, that skeptical brain of mine would go, whatever. Like, I don't have time for all that self-help stuff. And now I really realize, oh my God, they are that successful because they did that.
That's exactly right. And when I was a kid, I lived in libraries reading all that stuff and listening to Earl Nightingale, Zig Ziglar, Jim Rohn.
Earl Nightingale's the best. Yeah.
Started going to these seminars and it changed everything. And in fact, it was far more valuable. I'm a lawyer, far more valuable than all the education I could get. Because it changes the way you think and the way you approach things.
Yeah, it's so true. All right. Where can people go to learn more and connect with you?
SkipPritchard.com. There's no T in Pritchard is the best place. Also, my book is at thebookofmistakes.com. And you can find me all over at Skip Pritchard on Twitter and LinkedIn, all those normal places.
And really, Launch Readers, it is a fantastic book. And what I really loved about it, and it really worked for me as I read through it, was the mistakes are, and I say this as the highest compliment, obvious. You know, like I would read them and go, oh my God, of course. Like,
right.
Obviously, like I can do something about that, versus ones where you have to really, where they get overly complicated and it's frustrating. This, as I was reading through, it just felt very natural. Like, oh, I get it. I see these things and I can see where they're happening in my life. So thank you for making it so simple. Last piece of advice. What's the first step we launch readers can take to overcome some mistakes?
Well, the very first key is reading the book. No,
of
I'm just
course.
Kidding. The first is awareness and to find out which one you're making. In fact, at thebookofmistakes.com, I have a quiz where you can take it and it will give you your key character from the book and your strength zone so that it can make you more self-aware. But I think self-awareness is the key. Which one are you falling prey to right now and why? And what do you need to do about it? Oftentimes, you know, you're saying it's not surprising. Truth usually isn't. And so if you reflect and kind of think, okay, what is it? It's just taking the time to pause and read and say, okay, what do I need to do a little bit differently? And it's oftentimes just a little click to the left or right and everything changes. It's usually not massively dramatic life changes that will make the most difference for you.
Well, and I think that's the beauty of kind of what you have in the book and life in general, is if it's that, you know, 2% change that makes all the difference, it takes the overwhelm out of it, I think, to realize that.
I think it does.
Yeah. Skip, thank you so much. This has been truly profound. And the limitation as an invitation just rocked my world. So, among other things. So, thank you.
Awesome. Well, thank you for your tremendous resource that you provide. It is really one of those things to change the microphone in our minds.
I love that. Before you go, I want you to get really intentional about what's going on between your ears. I think half the time, or maybe even more, our inner voices are talking to us in almost a whisper. You can't do it. It's not going to happen. You're being crazy. They're going to think you're stupid. I don't think we even realize it's happening unless we take some time to pay attention and go inward. If you want to innovate, you've got to change that voice in your head. And as Skip said, it's the loudest. Tamara, out.
Thanks for hanging with us on Inside Launch Street. If you know someone that is truly ready to unlock their innovation advantage, have them join you on Launch Street. Discover your innovation advantage. Build a team of high-performing innovators and ignite ideas and solutions that create massive impact. GOTO, launchstreet.com. Remember, innovators, if you don't take the leap, somebody else will.